From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, rallying to salvage the Affordable Care Act.
Well, there's no question we should make it better. That should be our focus. We shouldn't have our rallying cry repeal. We should have our rallying reply to say, let's make it better.
Plus,
if he didn't pose himself as a controversial candidate, saying some of the things he did, I don't think he'd be president.
We talk with Michiganders who voted for Donald Trump and former Western coach P.J. Fleck taking a big chunk of his recruits with him to Minnesota. Sports commentator John U. Bacon weighs in.
I'll give a 17-year-old kid a whole lot of slack. You know, do the best you can. A 35-year-old millionaire, I give less slack.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How has the Affordable Care Act affected you? This week, we take a closer look at how Obamacare has played out in homes around Michigan. Also, Donald Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States this Friday. All week, we'll hear from Michigan voters who believe the president-elect's message and find out how they'll measure success with the new administration. But first, thousands showed up at a rally in Warren yesterday where Democratic presidential candidate and Senator Bernie Sanders, along with Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York, and Michigan Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters, all joined together vowing to fight Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It was one of dozens of rallies held across the country in support of Obamacare. Michigan Senator Gary Peters is here with us now. Senator, what are you hearing from Michigan voters with regard to the ACA and the Republican repeal efforts?
People are very concerned about what they're hearing about a repeal. We have hundreds of thousands of people in this state that now have health insurance that didn't have it before, now have the peace of mind that goes with that, and they're frightened, quite frankly. And I think it was quite striking to have the large crowd that we had yesterday. Here was a very cold Sunday. And we had thousands of people show up at this rally and say that, you know, do not repeal the Affordable Care Act, and especially without any kind of replacement. Here we have Republicans talking about repeal and yet have no idea how to replace it.
Late yesterday, Mr. Trump told the Washington Post he's working on a plan that would have the goal of, and I'm quoting here, insurance for everybody, although he wouldn't offer specifics. What have you heard in terms of specific from your Republican colleagues on the Hill or from the incoming Trump administration?
Well, that's the problem. I haven't heard any specifics. In fact, the Republicans have never been about giving specifics in a comprehensive way. They've been talking about repeal for probably 7 years now, and yet they still do not have a plan, do not have specifics, talking about just voting on a repeal and saying, well, maybe we'll replace it sometime in the future. But that just causes chaos. It causes chaos in the medical markets. You talk to folks who are providers, what that means for them, for hospitals. People are very, very concerned, and rightfully so. But you know, most importantly are those people who now have health care coverage, folks who oftentimes would come to me with tears in their eyes and thank me for supporting the Affordable Care Act because now they had the peace of mind that went with it, and often suffering from various ailments and diseases. Now those same people have tears in their eyes worrying that it's going to be taken away.
And is there anything that you feel can be done? I mean, the rallies sent a message, but is that enough?
Well, the rallies definitely sent a message, but we can't just have rallies. Everybody who's at a rally and everybody who believes that this is simply wrong has to make sure they're calling their member of Congress. They need to make sure their voice is heard and loud. And you know, we're hearing some of my Republican colleagues are having some second thoughts that they should not vote for a repeal without a replacement attached to it. And so there are some cracks, and I think it is more imperative than ever that people make sure that their voice is heard and start calling their members of Congress and stopping this rush to repeal without any idea how to replace it.
Senator Peters, it's no secret the Affordable Care Act has also caused some strain for people. People have had premiums go up. Insurance companies have abandoned it in some markets. People have not been able to keep or choose their doctors, to name a few problems. And Democrats have conceded some fixes need to be made. I'm wondering, what would those fixes look like in your view?
Well, there's no question we should make it better. That should be our focus. We shouldn't have our rallying cry repeal. We should have our rallying reply to say, let's make it better. And to make sure that where it's not working as well as it should, that we fix it. It's It's Medicare has been an incredibly successful program for our seniors. When it passed, we have gone back again and again to make changes and to make corrections. The same thing should occur with the Affordable Care Act. Unfortunately, we've had Republicans that have had no desire to try to make it better over these last few years because they were chanting their repeal chant at their own political rallies. But now, we need to come together and make sure that this is better and focus on what I hope is a core belief for all of us in America. And that's a big part of these rallies and one that I'm passionate about, is that everybody in this country, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, you should have access to quality, affordable health care. That's where we have to start this discussion. The Affordable Care Act focused on that, not that it doesn't have imperfections that we have to work on. We need to do that, but we need to be united around that core concept.
Senator Peters, I'd like to turn to the confirmation hearing held late last week for retired Marine Corps four-star General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, you voted for something we haven't seen since 1950, a waiver to let General Mattis serve as our Civilian Defense Secretary. Why did you vote yes?
Well, it was a hard vote, and I believe very strongly that we have to keep a very clear line with civilian control of the military. It's something that goes back to our early history, back to George Washington when he resigned his commission as well. He's probably one of the most passionate about keeping a clear line between military and civilian government. We have a law in place that says that someone who has been in the military has to be out for 7 years prior to taking the job of Secretary of Defense, and there was a waiver before us. General Mattis has been out 3 years, similar to General Marshall, which was the last time we've had a waiver of this time. I voted for it, though, because I believe General Mattis is a very thoughtful commander. He's well-read. He has even written and edited a book on civilian control of the military, so came with that kind of background. But I'll tell you what was most compelling is that actually the Republican witness that we had before our Committee on Armed Services, the Republican witness said he wants to be clear. He was very critical of President Obama and a number of actions that he took. But he went on to say, and this is a Republican witness, he went on to say his criticisms of President Obama pale in comparison to his concerns about President-elect Trump, that he simply doesn't have the temperament, doesn't have the knowledge, and could get our country into a very difficult situation. And to have someone of General Mattis's stature to push back is essential to preserving our republic.
Michigan Senator Gary Peters. Senator, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Walk into Marvin's Marvelous Mechanical Museum in Farmington Hills, and you're instantly immersed in a cacophony of beeps and airplane motors and singing flamingos. Every nook, cranny, and space is stuffed with arcade games, coin-operated machines, peculiar figurines with questionable purposes. Think of the Zoltar machine that turned a little boy into Tom Hanks in the movie Big, and multiply it tenfold. Marvin Yogoda, the museum's founder, is responsible for the fantastic mess. He began the collection in 1960. It's grown to become one of the World Almanac's 100 most unusual museums in the U.S. Last week, Marvin Yogoda died at 78 years old. As the museum noted on its Facebook page, the world is a lot less marvelous today. Stateside's Lindsay Scullin and Menachem Kaiser made a pilgrimage to Marvin's Marvelous Mechanical Museum just before he died and brought us this audio postcard.
I'm Ruby Kalman. I have been working here for like 6 or 7 months, but I've been coming here my whole life. It's a cool place. My dad knew Marvin a little bit. He was a pretty cool guy. He did a lot in his life. When all the Ripley's Believe It or Nots were going around closing, he went around the country and bought a bunch of stuff, which is where a lot of this stuff came from. Is that gonna fall? No. I mean, like, sometimes stuff falls, but we don't really deal with it until it falls, because, you know, you never know. You see the guy hanging upside down there with the weird tufts of hair? We call him our living corpse. He's here. He's a corpse. I mean, some of the stuff just kind of came to be. Your brain kind of tunes it out, but there's, like, a lot of noise in here, the machines. A lot of the stuff in here, nobody knows what it is. Like, the ceiling fans, and Marvin doesn't know sometimes. Like, there have been instances where we've asked, like, where did this come from? And I was like, I don't know. Some of the stuff in here is a mind of its own, I guess.
Jackpot! My name is Carl Van Dommelen. I had the high score, and then they updated the code, and then I was no longer the grand champion. So I've been trying to beat it ever since. I came close on there, so not too bad.
Tom beat me.
Yeah. Well, I got lucky. I'm Tom Leonard. Lived here for 19 years, so take my daughter here. And, you know, still play pinball once a week, really. Sometimes it's hard because video games, you know. Everybody plays them at home, so it's, mostly it's now kids, I think, coming to play for the game and winning coupons more so.
My name is Spencer. I like getting tickets because there are some really cool prizes there. I like to play the jump rope. It gives you a lot of tickets and you only have to put three in for a three-coin jackpot.
Welcome to Seven Jackpots Virtual. Booty high, booty low, either way it's gonna go.
That's faster each time.
You wait till my smoke break's over? All right, all right. Let's make this quick. Let her rip!
The caricature of Marvin is a little Cupid.
Uh-oh!
He's here a lot. He's kind of a character to collect all this stuff. It's great. It's great.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision. Part of the community.
The next idea.
Getting cities right will be very, very important, not just for the recovery, but for the long-term sustained growth.
Last month, Traverse City officials pledged that by the year 2020, all city operations will be powered by renewable energy. That means traffic signals, streetlights, and city-owned buildings will all get their power from wind, solar, and other clean sources. Let's find out more about just what that means as we welcome Kate Madigan. She's an energy specialist with the Michigan Environmental Council, director of the Michigan Climate Action Group, and she is a Traverse City resident. Kate, good to have you on The Next Idea.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why has Traverse City chosen renewable energy for city operations by 2020? Why this decision?
By passing this resolution, Traverse City has joined 20 other cities around the nation that have set 100% renewable energy goals. And three cities have already achieved this. So Traverse City is just one of the many cities that are seeing the benefits of moving to renewable energy for communities.
What do you think convinced city leaders to take this step?
There is a number of local organizations and community members that were really supportive of Traverse City setting this goal. And we worked with the mayor and the city commissioners and talked with them about the benefits and about what it would entail. And they saw the benefits of clean energy already and were interested in Traverse City taking this step.
So this wasn't a top-down decision. This really was something that residents had a voice in.
Yes, absolutely. It was, you know, our Mayor Jim Crothers is supportive of renewable energy. He was involved with Traverse City getting the first utility-grade wind turbine installed in the 90s here in Traverse City. So a lot of our work didn't entail too much convincing because he and other members of the City Commission saw the benefits and the importance of renewable energy, but the community members really helped move this forward.
So here we've got this goal, 100% renewable power in 4 years for city operations. But of course, that doesn't mean homes and private businesses, which certainly account for a big chunk of power use. So what about them? How does the city's decision, do you think, affect the houses and the private buildings?
Our hope is that they will be next, that this will serve as a step towards getting all of our energy to come from renewable energy in the future. And that's actually one of the goals included in this resolution is for a plan to be developed. A green team will be formed, made up of city officials and city staff and community members, and will come up with a plan for how our whole community can be run on 100% renewable energy before mid-century.
Well, how would the infrastructure have to change for this to happen in the four-year deadline?
For Traverse City to meet this goal in 4 years, it would mean that the city would need to get all of its electricity needs from renewable energy. That's about 10,000 megawatt hours per year. And so Traverse City gets its power from Traverse City Light and Power, the electric utility here, and they would need to purchase that much more renewable energy into their portfolio. So that would be equivalent to about buying 3.5 megawatts in a new wind farm, for example.
And is that expensive? Because I think for most of us, we don't get what that means. Is that a costly thing to do? And if so, where would the money come from?
It's not. In fact, Traverse City Light and Power, the utility, just in June looked at purchasing this amount of electricity from a wind farm, and it was found that it would actually be cheaper than the 2014 overall, the wholesale cost of power. So actually, renewable energy is now the least expensive source of new generation. You know, that's what the Michigan Public Service Commission has said in their most recent reports. So renewable energy has changed so much in the past 5 to 10 years that the benefits are so clear that a lot of our work is just raising awareness about this and showing that it's possible.
And we know Grand Rapids has set a goal to use 100% renewable energy by 2025. The village of Northport has a plan to go fully renewable, shooting for 2020. So we know other cities are with you in this. If you were writing a manual for other Michigan cities and towns to make this switch and to go to all renewable energy for city operations, what would be your top piece of advice?
Well, first of all, we are working to put together a toolkit for other communities interested in setting 100% goals. So we hope to have that available soon. And every community is different and has its own set of challenges and opportunities. But in general, I would say first find out how much energy your community uses to get an idea of what it would take to get 100% renewable power. Many cities have climate action plans already in place that has that information. Second would be talk with your city leaders and build relationships with them and educate them on renewable energy. And the third thing is hold a meeting and bring together others in your community that want more renewable energy and then work together. In Traverse City, there are about a dozen of us that have been working together, meeting regularly, and we represent several organizations and community members, and we've brought together lots of different ideas. We've shared the work, and it's been fun to work together on this.
Kate Madigan of Traverse City, an energy specialist with the Michigan Environmental Council, and also the director of the Michigan Climate Action Group. Kate, we want to thank you very much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And John, it did not take too long for the other shoe to drop in Kalamazoo. First, we learned that P.J. Fleck is leaving Western to take the big jump to the Big Ten and coach at Minnesota. And now we're hearing a good chunk of his recruitment class is following him.
A very large chunk. You get 25 scholarships per year as a rule to give out. Of those, 10 are now going not to Western Michigan, but to Minnesota. Now, there is an unwritten rule, Cindy, when you change jobs, especially when you move up in the coaching ranks, that you're not supposed to take your recruiting class with you. One or two guys you probably can't stop from joining you, but you're not supposed to pitch them, basically. And clearly, P.J. Fleck was very aggressive in trying to get his top recruits to Minnesota. So he has violated the unwritten rule, not against the rules, for the record, just unwritten ones. So if I'm P.J. Fleck, my guess is that his statue will not be going up in Kalamazoo this week.
You know, I guess you can't blame the students. Oh, my goodness, I get to play at the Big Ten.
Right.
And I guess you can't blame him. He recruited these kids.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll give a 17-year-old kid a whole lot of slack. You know, do the best you can. A 35-year-old millionaire, I give less slack. Western Michigan set it up so you could succeed, and you did succeed. Western gave you everything you needed, and you turn around and you gut their class. That, to me, is uncool.
Is this an unprecedented amount of recruit plundering, if you will?
It's not unprecedented, but it's getting close. It's unusually high. Again, 1, 2, 3 is typical. 10 is very, very unusual.
So I guess the question remains then for his successor, Tim Lester. What do you do? I mean, isn't signing day right coming
you
up?
You work as hard and fast as you can because you have about 2.5 weeks. But I think Lester will be successful is my guess.
I guess it does raise that question, what a stepping stone school like Western can do to keep the program growing and thriving and getting shots like the Broncos got going to the Cotton Bowl.
It's the great challenge of a MAC program, yeah. Eastern, Western, Central, and so on, is that you can never keep it going for very long. If Harbaugh stays in Michigan, they're going to be good for a long time. If anyone's any good at Western or Central or Eastern, chances are they're going to leave, except for Herb Duramity at Central, who had a great thing going there for many, many years. That is the exception, not the rule.
What are your thoughts on Tim Lester, who's going to replace Fleck?
Anyone you're going to get at a school like that is going to be usually young and largely unknown, and he is. But he was a star quarterback at Western in the late 90s, so he loves the place, set all the records. He's been the quarterback coach at Purdue, so he knows the Big Ten. He's had the big boy headset on for a little while. So it's always a bit of a gamble, but my sense is very positive.
I want to pivot over to an interesting opinion piece on thepostgame.com, how college football can learn from demise of newspapers written by, oh, look, John U. Bacon. What can college football learn from the problems that newspapers are coping with?
I would say two things. One, you better invest in your product, not just take the profits. And two, you better invest in the next generation of fans or readers. And journalism, we failed miserably at both. The print guys did, certainly, and I'm one of them. They're making 20% profits in the 90s. A grocery store makes 3%. Those are killer margins. They did not put the money back into the product at the MLive papers. In 1998, they did not have company email in 1998. They had one internet computer per news site. So one of the old executives walking through who made a ton of money was joking that it's going to be a fad like CB radio. The internet is. Well, there you are. And second thing is the next generation. They did not invest in high school readers and college readers. They should have been dumping free papers at every high school in the state of Michigan or in the United States. The way Camel cigarettes or Budweiser would have killed to do. They're not allowed to, and they failed to do so, and now you're in trouble. How that relates to college football is the games are later and later. They're more and more expensive. You don't see kids going to Big Ten games very often anymore. The national title game was at 8:30 on a Monday night, a school night. It ends after midnight. And when my kid's a little older, he is not going to be allowed to stay up to watch that. I'm sorry.
And the ratings reflected that, didn't it?
Of course they did. And what they're not looking at is the 45-year-olds are knocking out. Jim Harbaugh himself admitted he fell asleep halfway through it. All right, that's not the problem. The problem is the 12-year-old kid never even came close. And 20 years from now, when no one's watching college football, don't wonder why.
Warning words from Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is extra special importance to this Martin Luther King Day in Ypsilanti. Remarkably, it was 150 years ago on this day that abolitionist and orator Frederick Douglass spoke in Ypsilanti, one of three visits he made to the town. Today, Ypsilanti High School students are marking both MLK Day and the Douglass visit with a silent march to the site of the speech that happened in 1867 and also by opening an art exhibit. Here with us now, Lynn Settles, who teaches art at Ypsilanti High School, and student Christy Witkowski, who is a 12th grader. Welcome to both of you. So good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Lynn, tell us, why did Frederick Douglass visit Ypsilanti on this day in 1867? What do we know about it?
Well, from my understanding is that he was on a tour of this part of the state. So Ypsilanti happened to be one of the stops. He was also in Ohio and some other communities in this area. The research is still out as to why he chose Ypsilanti as opposed to mother cities.
And here we are. You think about this date in 1867. Less than 2 years past the end of the Civil War, and his speech that day was titled The Perils to the Republic. What did he say that day?
He had so much to say. One of the things that we found that was really important is there was a paragraph in the speech that rings important and the same for today. The struggles of equality, the struggles of free speech. Some of the political turmoil that we're going through right now were some of the things that they were struggling with then.
So where did the idea of today's silent march and also the art exhibit, where did those germs of the idea come from?
Most of it came from the students. So after the election results, I came to school and I had a bunch of blank faces and sad faces, a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, a lot of fear. So what I did was I gave them art supplies, pencil, paper, crayons, markers, scissors, glue, magazines, and allowed them to make these little mini small posters about how they were feeling. And just as they said, anger, fear. And so I shared them with a colleague of mine over at U of M. He took pictures over to his students. He said, they're feeling the same way. We came back together, had a big group meeting with the students. They said, you know, Ms. Settles, you're always telling us that art is a form of communications. Well, I know we're not 18 yet, but we would like our voices heard. And that was sort of the beginning of it. They decided for the silent march. They decided to do the posters.
Christy, what did you feel that you and the other marchers were saying by your presence and also the posters you carried?
I definitely think it was just about peace, equality, and justice, and all of us coming together to support that. Because even with the posters we made about the election, showing how angry we didn't really have to speak to show what we felt. And I think that's why we also chose to be silent during this march, because it just means like everyone coming together can have one voice, and a bundle of sticks is harder to break than just one stick.
When you think about a speech that happened 150 years ago, or even for that matter, Dr. King, because it's been nearly 49 years since he was assassinated. That's a long time for someone who's a 12th grader. What has this process of exploring your feelings through art done to kind of connect you with these events from the past?
It's just empowering to be able to be doing something about this at 17, 18, even people younger who are like 14, 15 who've joined in on this. And I think it's made an impact on a lot of people's lives, because even the younger generation, we'd always see like the college kids or the adults doing something or hearing about Martin Luther King or Frederick Douglass or many other people in history. And now we're realizing we actually can put our foot down and stand for what we believe.
And so the march took you actually to the spot where Frederick Douglass spoke, which is, you know, quite stupendous to think on this Martin Luther King Day that that was the same day. But talk to us a little about the art. I understand, I know, Christy, you worked on, there's a life-size paper mache statue of Frederick Douglass?
Yeah, me and a group of peers at school actually worked on this statue of Frederick Douglass. It's 6 feet. It's paper mache. We had sculpted it out of clay first, and then we plastered it, and then covered it in newspaper and pulled off the cast, and I made some prosthetics for his face and like made a wig and did some makeup, and we had an actor come. And well, actually, the students read the speech. We thought it'd be very empowering to have the students be able to say that.
So he is speaking. He is, this statue is...
The statue is speaking for 24 hours until the end of this month.
Mm-hmm.
So it's set up in the front of the gallery space. You can't go inside, but the statue is right in front of the glass door.
And where is that?
Yes Gallery, which is at 8 North Washington Street in Ypsilanti. You can walk past there and you can actually see, it looks like a hologram of Frederick Douglass. And the voices that you hear are the students.
What role, and do you think art is going to play in President Donald Trump's America?
Ooh. Well, art's going to be the voice of the people. It's definitely going to be the voice of a lot of people. Even just coming here, we saw other protest marches going on and signs. And I know within the arts community, within Ipsy and Ann Arbor, a lot of artists are getting together and using art as a way to express how they're feeling right now. And so my expectations are that that's going to keep going.
Yeah, I definitely think Trump also acts dangerously on impulse and doesn't like to let people speak and say what they want to. So I think art definitely disturbs reality a bit for most people, and I think it will hopefully disturb some people's thinking and make them reevaluate life and like where they're at right now and what they stand for.
How long will the exhibit run, and where can people go?
Two locations. We have the Yes Gallery, which is on 8 North Washington Street. Frederick Douglass speaking will be going on 24 hours until the 27th of this month. And then right next door, almost directly, at Go Ice Cream, the students have a photography exhibit up. And that will be open from like 9 to 5, the same hours that the Go Ice Cream is open.
Lynn Settles, who teaches art at Ypsilanti High School, and 12th grader Christy Witkowski, talking to us about today's silent march and the art exhibit commemorating the 150th anniversary of an Ypsilanti speech given by Frederick Douglass, and of course, honoring Martin Luther King on his day. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come.
There were all these closet Trump supporters out there, and I could feel it.
We will learn about Michiganders' expectations for the incoming Trump administration. That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Listening to Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. The inauguration of Donald Trump as our 45th president is this Friday. All this week, we'll hear from people in Michigan who supported Mr. Trump, find out what their expectations are for the new administration. Dr. Michael Basuito is a plastic surgeon based in Oakland County who was just elected to the Wayne State University Board of Governors. He supported Donald Trump's candidacy. Stateside's Lester Graham recently spoke with Dr. Basuito.
There were several Republicans running for the nomination. Do you recall when Trump first caught your attention?
Yes, actually I do. Earlier in the summer, I was visiting my mother's house. She's 87, lives by herself in Shelby Township, and friends were there. And suddenly, everyone had to be quiet, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and they were mesmerized. They were watching the TV at her house, and it turns out all these hardcore old Italian people are mesmerized by Donald Trump. When I saw that, I said, you know, this guy, he does have a movement going. If it's happening in my mother's living room, I'm sure it's happening across the country. There were all these closet Trump supporters out there, and I could feel it. That was the first time I felt it.
What Trump policies seem on target for you?
I don't know if it's any policy per se, but I'm in private practice. I'm a plastic surgeon, and so I'm a small businessman. If you look what's happening to us people who are in small business across the country with the rules and regulations that are coming down from Washington, it's obvious that people are imposing rules and regulations on us who have never, ever spent one day of their whole life in the private sector. And my feeling was, hey, we've got a guy now who is a businessman. He understands business. He understands how it works. Maybe he will impose some governmental rules that really work and that apply to the real world and small business.
Since you're a physician, I want to ask you about the Affordable Care Act. President-elect Trump has said he wants it to be repealed and then replaced. What's your thinking about the ACA?
The main issue is that, you know, if you look at the trajectory of health care costs in this country, I think we're approaching the 20% of GDP range. And if you look at the trajectory, it keeps going up and up. And if the trajectory of health care costs in this country as a percentage of GDP continues to rise, we're going to get to a point where we're not sustainable financially. I think there was a good intention in that. If you heard the president talk about it, he said he wanted to bend the curve down. However, the opposite is happening. It's not unusual for me to see patients with $8,000, $12,000 deductibles. So they'll come in my office and they'll say, I can afford my premium now, but I can't afford to get sick because the average Joe doesn't have $8,000 to $12,000 of expendable cash to put out if they get an illness.
Let me step back just for a second because I've heard some members of Congress say, look, let the free market take care of this. This shouldn't even be replaced. Do you think of health care as a privilege or a right?
I think that in a we practice welfare capitalism. I like to think that we're one of the most civilized countries in the world, if not the most. And I think along with that, I think that we are obligated to take care of everybody, which I think would place this in the category of a right.
Since as Wayne State University, governor, or you will be soon anyway, you'll be making decisions for one of the state's major universities. How will the sensibilities that led you to support Trump translate to higher education policies for you?
Let me give you an example. I talked to the second and third year students at our medical school about return on investment for medical education. There is not a day that goes by where I don't have a medical student who's north of $300,000 in debt. I see them regularly now with $400,000 in debt, and some now over $500,000 in debt. Here's the problem with that. They're entering into after medical school, they can't afford to even pay the interest on the debt, and the compound interest curves keep running on them. And they don't understand that at that stage in their career when they're borrowing this money, that number one, you got compound interest curves running. And number two, when they pay it back, they're going to pay it back in after-tax dollars, most of it. Number three, they're paying a 7.1% interest rate, which is outrageous in today's world. And some of these poor kids, when they look at it, if they want to be a family practitioner or a pediatrician, they realize that they will never, ever get out of debt, despite the fact they're going to be working as a physician. Getting back to your original question, as a member of the Board of Governors,
we're going to oversee policy in the university. I think we're obligated to educate kids in what is going to maximize their future. And I'm not talking about just financially, but I don't want these kids to pursue careers or paths where they don't understand where their debt's going to lead them and subject them to a life of just having to pay back loans.
What do you make of Mr. Trump's demeanor, his tweets reacting to perceived slights, his statements critical of intelligence agencies or their motives, and that kind of thing?
Oh, I think it's all calculated. I think that he's a very smart guy. He comes, as you know, I've never watched any. I don't watch TV. I watch news programs and sports as the extent of my TV watching, so I've never watched any of his shows. But, you know, we've become a country that's become addicted to the media. And, you know, the media thrives on sex, violence, and all kinds of controversies. And I think that if he didn't pose himself as a controversial candidate saying some of the things he did, I don't think he'd be president today. And I think he's learned how to use the media.
But he's no longer a candidate.
I understand. And I think you'll see him change course, because I think that was all calculated. Myself personally, I mean, I can't say, I've never met the man, so I can't speak for him or his team. However, if you get a guy like Trump, who's been extremely successful in the New York real estate market, I think you're dealing with a tough guy. And like he said in his campaign, you know, if you punch me, I'm going to punch you back. And I don't think the country is used to somebody in his position who's going to take on the press. And I just saw that. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I saw that little sparring that took place the other day between he and a CNN reporter.
Mm-hmm. John Costa.
Fake
right.
News issue. I think you can take a shot at him. I think he's going to make you pay the price.
As a reporter, I'll have to defend Jim Acosta, because he wasn't broadcasting fake news, but we'll go on from there. Where do you get your news?
I watch all sources. I watch, well, I work so much I don't get to watch it much, but I channel surf between Fox, MSNBC, NBC, and I follow online. I follow the Daily Mail. I like to read Pravda, you know, the Russian outlet. I watch them all. I listen to them all.
I want to ask you one last question. How will you measure success for President Trump?
You know, I don't know which president it was who made the comment about it's the economy, stupid. I think it was
it was Bill Clinton's campaign.
Anyway, it's about the economy. I think what people want, they want jobs. I don't think it's a matter of black, white, red, yellow. It's a matter of what we do with the economy and what he does with jobs and growing our economy. If he does that, I think a lot of other things will fix themselves. I think you'll see people becoming more content with their government and their country.
Michael Pesuito was recently elected to the Wayne State University Board of Governors. He's among the several Donald Trump supporters we've been talking to prior to the inauguration. Hey, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The future of the Affordable Care Act is certainly in doubt. President-elect Donald Trump wants to scrap it and replace it. The Republican majority in Congress is totally on board with that idea. According to government figures, nationwide, since the Affordable Care Act's coverage expansion began, some 20 million uninsured people have gained health insurance coverage. Census data show the uninsured rate in Michigan in 2015 was cut in half. It's now at 6.1%, down from 12.4% uninsured in 2010. But there are problems. Some families are worse off. Before the ACA, Melissa Dabbert and her family had the kind of insurance coverage they needed. After the ACA went into effect, the Dabberts couldn't find the same coverage, and anything that met their needs was much more expensive. Stateside's Lester Graham spoke with Melissa Dabbert.
First, if you don't mind, tell me about your family's health care needs.
Sure. My husband and I and our two children have significant disabilities. So we are actually a family who need health insurance. Looking from a perspective of actually having to use the insurance, we see it from a little bit different perspective than many people who don't need to use it.
So give me an example of what kind of cost of procedures? Are we talking about having to go into the hospital a lot? Or are we talking about having to see the doctor a lot? Give me an idea of what your situation is.
Yes. I and my two children have a disability called osteogenesis imperfecta. It's a brittle bone condition that from time to time we may experience a broken bone, and sometimes that requires surgical repair. So it does involve sometimes hospital care as well as routine doctor visits.
What happened to the insurance coverage you had before the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it was canceled as a result of the regulations under the Affordable Care Act. And we were surprised because we were under the understanding that if you liked your plan, you could keep your plan. But we received a letter from Blue Cross, who was the company we had at the time, that said our actual plan was being canceled as a direct result of the new regulations under the Affordable Care Act.
What was the advantage to that plan?
Well, what we appreciate about the plan is the fact that it had an out-of-pocket maximum of $2,500 for both of our children combined. And I think that's where it's important to think about. A lot of the policies that came out after the Affordable Care Act had lower premiums, but the benefits were not good if you had to use the insurance.
So a higher out-of-pocket expense and so forth.
Yep, we went from a $2,500 combined out-of-pocket maximum to a $5,100 per child out-of-pocket maximum.
So almost four times what you were paying.
Yes, and again, if you didn't need to use the insurance, it was great. But if you have to use insurance, that's where it becomes an issue.
I also understand that as the years have gone by under ACA, you've had to change plans because they get altered or they aren't available any longer.
Almost every year.
Yeah. What's been your experience that way?
Well, again, the plans change. We have to spend hours every year at the end of the year trying to figure out what plans would work for us. And there's not many plans offered in our county particularly, and there's only like three companies. One or two of the companies didn't even provide pay for our local hospital care.
So let me stop you just for a second, because you mentioned in your county, it's a statewide marketplace, but they sell county by county?
Yes, yes. Blue Cross can choose to offer a particular plan in one county or the next. And so if I should move out of Bay County, I have to notify the insurance company because they may not offer it in another county.
I'm wondering what kind of help you've gotten to kind of negotiate all of this, search for a policy that meets your family's needs.
Well, we do have a local agent that works with us, but by the time we sit down and discuss what our family's needs are, it ends up to be one, two, and maybe possibly three choices. And we kind of joke about it, sadly enough, by saying we either have an option between a bad, a really bad, or a really bad, bad plan. So it's not the variety of options that we thought we were going to have.
The deadline to sign up for the Affordable Care Act for 2016 was on December 15th. Were you able to find something?
We did. Well, I mean, we had to pick something. It was either pick something or have nothing. And we did pick a plan. The plan that we chose for our children was it had a $5,100 out-of-pocket maximum per child with a deductible of $250 per year.
So that's much like that first plan you got a couple of years ago, it sounds like.
Yep, yes.
A lot of people have been able to get health care insurance that just wasn't available to them before the ACA, people with pre-existing conditions, for example. I'm wondering, what do you think is the best way for the government to go forward if there is some kind of a health care plan that's offered by some kind of act, whether it's ACA for another year or two or something that's come up that's new from the Congress or the Trump administration? What do you want to see in that?
Well, I think that pre-existing conditions should remain part of the requirements. I think most people agree with that. I think what is most important is that you have a reasonable out-of-pocket maximum for families who need to use the insurance. I mean, when you're sick and you can't work, that becomes a huge issue when you can't afford, I mean, when you need to use the insurance, you're probably going to max out on the insurance every year.
I want to just touch on one thing. You say if you work or if you're not working, was Medicaid ever an option for you or your kids?
Well, my children could have made the decision to take Medicaid this year. They are 18 now, and they are in college. The only way that they could have received Medicaid is if they, you essentially have to be extremely in poverty to be able to get Medicaid. Now, let me just back up by saying, you don't have to be in extreme poverty, but if you have a savings account, you have to spend it down to $2,000. That's the most that you can have in a savings account in order for Medicaid to even kick in and provide any payment whatsoever. And so my kids have a college savings and wanted to be able to maintain that savings, so they could not go on Medicaid without spending down their assets to $2,000.
So I want to just give you one more chance to bottom line it for, you said pre-existing conditions, that has to be a thing, and a reasonable amount of payments. What kind of hope for a plan like that do you see in the next year or two?
Well, I'm very optimistic, but I'm cautiously optimistic. I think that I'm really concerned that more decisions are going to be made without discussing the potential outcomes with families who are affected. I think what happened is a lot of decisions were made at the federal level without talking to anybody and saying, gee, if we made this change, what will happen to your family? What's going to be the outcome for you? And right now, the way the system is set up, if you can't afford your premiums, you basically are going to end up poor if you can't afford to pay your medical bills.
That's Melissa Davert. She and her family have been faced with some tough and expensive health care insurance decisions since the Affordable Care Act was implemented. I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, too. I appreciate your attention to the issue.
And tomorrow, we'll hear how the ACA offered support and relief for a family coping with pre-existing conditions. With possible repeal, they face an uncertain future. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.